Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. So it's 1 week into our winter retreat, having a full schedule of sitting, walking, meditation, reflections, readings, and working along the themes of Satipatthana. And we started after some definitions and explanation of terms and general ideas on Satipatthana of working our way into contemplation of the body. And just to make note of the fact that these contemplations, as we go through them, they're part of a whole. There's many different avenues for practice that the Buddha has taught, because getting to the bottom of suffering and its ending, it has different aspects to it. The way that suffering manifests in our lives is kind of multifaceted, with a lot of different roots. Greed, hatred, delusion have different qualities to them. We need a set of tools to examine them all with. It's not just one technique isn't usually sufficient for most of us with our complicated minds and the ways that we can experience dukkha. So we need to oftentimes use a number of different kinds of tools to help chip away at the obstructions and confusions that keep us from seeing things clearly in a way that will help us let go of old habits and conditions that lead us into difficulty, distress, unsatisfactoriness, suffering. A lot of these tools are ways of helping to find balance in our experience. And also, sometimes the tools are oftentimes balancing each other, depending on how dukkha is manifesting, sometimes in what seems almost like diametrically opposed ways. So tools are quite variable. Knowing when to apply them and when to use them is a real important part of the training. There's a teaching, a discourse from the Udana that kind of spells out a few of a really nice basic set of core teachings that really address a spectrum of issues. It involves a monk named Meghiya, who at one time was the Buddha's attendant. He's gone into a village one day for his alms food, and as he's going to the village or coming back from the village, he notices a very nice grove, a bamboo grove, no, a mango grove, where it looks like it might be a nice place to set up for practice. And when he gets back to the Buddha, he asks the Buddha if he can go and spend some time in this mango grove on his own to develop his practice. It seems like it might be a good place to do that. And the Buddha hesitates and says, "Well, hang on for a bit, Meghiya. There's nobody else here but you and me, and wait till another monk comes along, and then we can consider it." Meghiya, feeling quite certain of his desire and his wish to go off to this grove, asks the Buddha a second time, and again the Buddha says, "Well, not yet, just wait." And Meghiya continues for a third time, says, "Please, can I go?" And the Buddha says, "Okay, you've asked 3 times, you want to do it for your own development of your practice, so go ahead, go and spend some time there, see what happens." So he goes off to the mango grove and sits down to practice, and finds himself fairly quickly beset with lots of images of sensuality, lots of images of aversion, general confusion, and is just not settling down. And it's definitely not what it was that he was expecting in terms of a great peaceful abiding. And so he kind of comes back to the Buddha and relates what had happened. And the Buddha says, yeah, well, you know, when the mind is not ready for this kind of seclusion, this kind of intense solitude, then that's what happens, you know, when the mind is unprepared. And the commentaries kind of have this a bit of an explanation, a little bit of background from the commentaries that says that actually Megye, and I think they said 500 past lives, was a king in that area. And that particular place, that grove where he was meditating, was a place where this, where in past lives as a king he would go and be entertained in a sense by his harem. So there was a lot of sensuality happening there, which was why he was experiencing this onslaught of sensual thoughts and images. And that also it was the same place where he ordered the execution of a lot of bandits and criminals, and so that he was kind of suffering the memories and consequences of all of that aversion. So he had all of these different kinds of images coming up. Of course, whether or not that's true or not is anybody's speculation, but it sounds good. You know, the Buddha gives him some instruction about various general attitudes that he needs to start engendering and working on, and you know, recollecting his precepts and establishing right effort towards wholesome mind states and associating with good people, you know, having good company to support it, and various other kinds of aspects of the general training in order to form a firm foundation before going off to solitude. And then he also points to four specific other more contemplative techniques that he suggests for Megye to start picking up and practicing with. And I find that these four are a very nice, concise set of techniques that hit on some different themes and also provide a real balanced approach to practice, and kind of try to myself use them in a way of practicing a balanced perspective, or a balanced having a balanced practice. So the four techniques that the Buddha suggests that Megye start developing are asubha, kamatana, asubha practice, contemplation of the unattractiveness of the body, which we started talking a bit the other day, yesterday, I guess, yeah. And then he also suggests metta bhavana, practice of metta, to help offset the aversion. And he suggests anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, and also reflections on anicca, impermanence, inconstancy, as four basic techniques for reflection to form a firm foundation for the practice, the meditation practice. So I always like to go back to these four basic techniques in my own life, in my own practice, because they really address a wide variety of issues, obstructions, essentially, in some way or another, addressing the whole round of greed, hatred, and delusion, the basis for suffering in our lives. So the asubha practice, as we were talking about, we were just getting started with that, is a fundamental practice for those who are looking to help decrease the impact of sensual craving There's different aspects of it. We were starting to talk particularly around the contemplation of the 32 parts of the body, just by going over the basic textual rendition of it. And we'll be looking more at that in the coming days, day after tomorrow, a couple of days worth of the slideshows that we had put together a few years ago. Been a request to re-look at those. So we'll be looking at that topic in the days to come. And it was a good discussion. We had a little bit of a discussion around it because it isn't something that's taught a lot in non-monastic circles, and even it's not taught a lot in some monastic circles these days, from what I understand, but forms a core teaching in many of our monasteries, particularly in Thailand. And we, many people here, use it too. And there does seem to be a general common misunderstanding, maybe outside the monastic community, that somehow it's not a useful practice for many people, in that it is kind of life-denying or causes a lot of ill will or aversion towards the body, a lot of negativity is thought to come from looking at the unattractive nature of the human body, and that you know, people have a lot of aversion already sometimes to their bodies, and that this is just something that increases that, and you know, causes negative, poor, shameful body image kinds of things. And so we had a discussion around that, and pointing out that, you know, that actually is clearly not the intention of the practice, and that, you know, unfortunately, some of the ways that Asubha has been translated into words like, you know, repulsiveness or loathsomeness of the body, disgust, the disgusting nature of it, that, things like that are a bit loaded, quite extreme, whereas Asubha really means just not attractive. And so that picked up incorrectly, you know, maybe could result in some of these states of mind that are not very productive. But that when used properly, they can be a very powerful tool for cutting through sensual craving, which is a cause for dukkha. You know, it's interesting. I was kind of thinking about that, that whole aspect, and a lot of, I think, the you know, the resistance that you know, people might have around this particular practice is because of this inflated idea of what we think the human body should be, that, you know, there's very strong conditioning and imagery that's, you know, part and part of our culture, you know, maybe, you know, many cultures around the world, that there's a certain standard of beauty that is considered ideal or, you know, important to attain, or, yeah, it's just put out there in so many ways through, you know, magazines and posters and you know, all sorts of media of what an attractive, beautiful human being should look like. And the more that we identify with the body as who we are and what we should be, then the more we're subject to trying to make it according to some sense of what a perfect human being should look like. Also as a way of, making oneself attractive to others or of satisfying one's sensual desires. So there's this very, very high standard of beauty and attractiveness that people end up measuring themselves up against. And it's a grounds for a lot of suffering. Because there aren't very many people who measure up to those standards. So, people develop these negative body images. A lot of emphasis can be put on helping people who may not measure up to these standards of attractiveness to see themselves as, good anyway, not to disparage themselves because they are chubby or because they're too skinny or because they're too tall or too short or because they've got a crooked nose, to kind of counteract that body image issue with kind of trying to prop up a sense of pride in what you are, just the way you are, skinny can be beautiful, fat can be beautiful, make a feature out of that crooked nose, be proud of who you are and what you are, and you're an attractive, beautiful person too. So, all the ways that we can try and counteract that sense of shame for not measuring up to a certain standard. And I guess that's, one way of doing it, but it seems like to me that it just kind of perpetuates this this idealism that this is what human bodies should be. And we make a lot of demands of ourselves and our expectations of what it, what we should look like, or how we should view ourselves, or how we measure up against other people, and in some ways, to me, that's not developing a very healthy sense of self. If it's just further perpetuating this identification with the body as something that should be attractive, something that should be beautiful, no matter what it looks like. And in a way, to me, it seems like a supa practice rather than being something that's, encouraging an unhealthy negativity towards the body, that a supa is really actually one of the most healthy ways that a person can view a body, because you're looking at everybody as not particularly attractive, whether they're conventionally attractive or not. You're trying to counteract that kind of whole sense of the importance of that. And you're looking at, somebody who's quote-unquote attractive, and you're basically just reflecting hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, bones, sinews, internal organs, fluids. That's what that attractive body over there is all about. And then you look at someone who's conventionally maybe not so attractive, whatever it is. And you're looking at that and you're just seeing hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, bones, sinews, internal organs, fluids, etc. So it's basically just equalizing what it is that we're referring to as the human body. And it's looking at it not in a way that is intended to cause aversion or disgust or shame, but in a way that's intended to just establish a sense of reality, looking past the ways that we try and attend to these features, signs and features of the human body in a way that's provocative of craving. And so if we can really use this practice as a way of seeing reality, unveiling the illusion of the human body, then we can start to relate to ourselves, you know, whether we're conventionally attractive or not, relate to other people, whether they're conventionally attractive or not, in a way that, you know, kind of sets aside that whole realm and can give us a chance to just, you know, chill out a little bit and relax and maybe not demand so much of what we expect from our bodies or the, you know, the bodies of other people. You know, we don't have to focus on them in as objects for gratification. That, to me, is a great relief and seems actually quite healthy. Because what it does, too, is it, you know, takes away this whole sting of comparison. It takes away the sting of identifying with a certain quality in our bodies. And then when things change and, you know, we get older and wrinkly and saggy and conventionally less attractive, then it's not a big deal because we haven't staked our claim there to begin with. And we have less expectation of that from other people, too. It opens the door for appreciating and encouraging, developing qualities that are more sustainable, more nourishing to the heart as well. If, you know, we're not so concerned with the body as a sensual object, then we can attend in ourselves and encourage other people and appreciate in other people the deeper qualities that are more long-lasting bases for happiness, kindness, compassion, relating to spiritual qualities and appreciating how we can be in relation to other people on a much broader level than one that's just trying to get something, in a way, even if it's a form of legitimate enough, but temporary gratification. So it broadens our ability to actually be in relationship to other human beings in a very real, deep way that's not dependent on this identification with the body as attractive, unattractive, and all of those things. So, in a way, it's an antidote to self-aversion based on a sense of incompleteness around our own bodies. So another teaching, reflection that the Buddha suggests to Meghia for developing is the one around development of loving kindness, metta. And I think, that obviously is working towards an antidote for aversion, hatred, ill will, that is part and parcel of many of our lives to one degree or another. If not, you know, overt, then oftentimes more subtle ways of experiencing aversion. And I think one way of looking at the experience of aversion in a way and dealing with it, one has to start a little bit, in my mind anyway, before trying to apply loving kindness or metta teachings onto the experience of aversion. Sometimes it's easy to get caught in the experience of aversion and feeling the unpleasantness of it and wanting immediately to get rid of it because it's such an unpleasant experience. You know, oftentimes the most immediate reaction is to strike back and defend oneself by attacking in some way or another, body, speech, or mind, or running away from, turning away from, just to not have to experience the object of our aversion. And that compounds things. That's adding more aversion on top of the aversion. But it's also not so easy to just immediately paste loving kindness right onto the top of it either. You know, we get sometimes critical of ourselves for feeling averse or feeling some sort of anger or irritation and immediately say, I should have loving kindness for that person. May they be well. May they be happy. May they be free from suffering. And all the time, there's this kind of underneath bubbling of I wish they would just go away. I wish I didn't have to experience this. You know, may they be really kind of secretly feeling, may they be unhappy. So before we get to that kind of training with metta, I think that there's a bit of groundwork that needs to be done. And, you know, perhaps one way of looking at it is kind of along the lines of using the format of the Four Noble Truths. And, you can say sort of like the first noble truth of aversion is, you know, acknowledging that it's there. There is aversion. Okay. What's that like? The duty to it would be to understand it, just as in the duty to suffering is to understand it in the first noble truth. So the duty to aversion is to not pretend that it's not there and not add that, you know, second arrow of aversion to the aversion, but just to acknowledge its presence. And even though it's an unpleasant feeling, to be able to open to it as an experience, as an emotional experience. It can be felt very strongly in the body. So we try and get ourselves in a place, you know, first of all, do no harm to the situation by, you know, trying to restrain oneself from acting out immediately in a situation. Try and find some space in your mind or even physical space away from the situation to sort of say, okay, this is aversion. This is what it feels like. Can I be with this and understand it? And to give it some space. So we have to know it, experience it, before we can deal with it in any kind of useful way. And then understanding the cause, you know, of this experience that, you know, I think it, you know, in the causes of suffering in the second noble truth, that you know, that aversion clearly is an experience of vibhava tanha, which is sort of this desire for it not to be. We wish for it to go away. It's unpleasant. The mind moves towards wanting to annihilate the experience. So understanding the cause and learning how to abandon that resistance. One of the ways that we can kind of approach that is by looking at what's realistic, what our expectations are. Sometimes it's easy to get caught in indignation, it's an aversive state, at the unskillfulness or the wrongness of somebody that we're having an interaction with or a situation that's come into our life, and to kind of have this feeling of it's not fair. It's not the way that it's supposed to be. They shouldn't be like this. They shouldn't do that. It's not right. Righteous indignation. Sometimes, you know, I often say and often feel that, you know, it's sort of like, well, we might be right, but we still are suffering the indignation, you know. And being right isn't always conducive to non-suffering. So, you know, we look at situations that we're in and find, you know, try and figure out how much control we have and how much control we don't have. One of the experiences that kind of comes to mind for myself fairly recently, just not too many days ago, you know, not a huge amount, but certainly I felt a bit of dosa arrive, a little aversion arise when I was asking about the status of one of our vehicles and that we had had it in for yet another repair of some kind, and didn't come to our attention until later on that it might be covered under a warranty. So, you know, putting in an application for seeing if we can get some money back on it from warranty coverage, and getting caught up in bureaucratic delays and getting the vehicle back, and not only getting the vehicle back and having paid for the price of it and waiting to see if we can get some of this money back, but also having it come back with something else wrong with it. And clearly went in working and it came out and this other part not working, and calling up the service people and, you know, kind of pointing that out and saying, well, you know, what happened? It immediately came back and you fixed one problem, but there's another problem. And, you know, something go wrong in the shop. And, oh, no. You know, we didn't do anything. It's just a coincidence. Sorry, we can't do anything about it. You know, it's you can bring it in again if you want to, but, you know, cost you $500 more dollars. Not to mention the towing in both directions, because we don't have our truck, which is also in the shop. So another $600. We'll be glad to fix it, but, you know, it's not our fault. It's just coincidence. You know, and maybe that's true. You know, we're not in a position to say, no, you're wrong. We don't know. But, you know, there was kind of this element of, you know, kind of nonchalantness. They're sort of the only business in town that takes care of these kinds of things, so we don't have too much choice. And it kind of reminded me of a old bumper sticker I was telling a couple of people about from the 70s, when just before the telephone company monopoly was broken up. And there used to be bumper stickers with the little logo of, I can't remember whether it was AT&T or one of the Bell system things, but anyway, it had that logo on it, and it basically said, "We don't care. We don't have to." And that's kind of what I was reminded of with this particular occurrence with the vehicle. And anyway, this is a bit of an aside, but it did cause a bit of aversion to arise. So I was noticing, okay, aversion, 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 aversion. I wasn't trying to plaster loving kindness onto the service person right at that point because I didn't think it would be very helpful. But one of the reflections that helped me was as well, you know, I guess we will still have to pursue this. This is not a you know, the book isn't closed on this one yet. We have some follow-up to do. But, you know, essentially right now and possibly later, there's nothing I can do about it. And there's no sense in, you know, dwelling in this, it's not fair kind of attitude, which is so tempting to jump into and delve into and make a meal of. There's a kind of a fairly blunt teaching that the Buddha offers along these lines that came to my mind too, that it's kind of, I think it's like 10 ways to subdue ill will or hatred, 10 ways to subdue hatred, and something like, you know, to subdue hatred, thinking, he caused me harm, so what do I expect? This is one way to subdue hatred. Or this will subdue hatred. And then, he is causing me harm. What do I expect? And he will cause me harm. What do I expect? This is the way to subdue hatred. Or, he caused harm to someone who is dear to me. So what should I expect? He is causing harm to someone who is dear to me, so what should I expect? He will cause harm to someone who is dear to me, so what should I expect? This is, these are ways to subdue hatred. Or, he is aiding someone who is not dear to me, so what should I expect? He has aided someone, and then he is aiding someone who is not dear to me, so what should I expect? And he will aid someone who is not dear to me, so what should I expect? And then the 10th one is, the last way to subdue hatred is to not get wound up in impossibilities. It's kind of a way of summing up that whole series. So it's kind of a blunt teaching and might seem a little bit heartless, but it's kind of pulling that, you know, right to the front, that if we want to not feel this sense of anger and ill will and indignation, then we have to realistically ask ourselves, well, what is my expectation? You know, this is the world of samsara. There are people who out there who would do unskillful things. And sometimes I'm the target of that, or people who are close to me are the target of that. Sometimes this is the way the world goes. And it's not a way, it's not saying that we shouldn't take action if we need to, or if we can, or if there's the potential for, you know, righting the wrong in some way, in some skillful way. But that if there's not, and we continue to dwell on it, you know, well, where's the suffering? Suffering is inside our response and our inability to let it be. Tanka Chana and I were on alms round this morning over to the Fries, and talking a little bit with Daniel, who was, as he, you know, has expressed before, sometimes finds it challenging raising a young kid, and particularly with him home much of the time, homeschooling, that kind of thing, having, you know, lots of feeling kind of on the spot all the time. That, you know, children can be quite demanding of time and energy, always wanting attention, as children do, and just feeling kind of tired, exhausted, spent, low on resources, and sometimes aversion develops, you know, just not being able to meet what feels like kind of, you know, ongoing needs of a young child, and wondering, you know, how to work with that, you know, and not feeling good about the sense of aversion that sometimes arises, you know, wanting to be always responding with loving kindness and compassion and altruism in difficult circumstances, and wondering how to do that. And I was, you know, trying to do the best I could to offer some, you know, some solace in a way, you know, of, you know, comments around, you know, well, you don't have to try and, you know, paste loving kindness into a situation where you're feeling some aversion right away. You know, try and be patient with yourself and, you know, patient with your child, and, you know, developing a larger state of mind that can contain it all, and you know, trying to just relax a bit and not, you know, be so demanding on yourself, and you know, just to be with it in a more spacious way, things like that. You know, stuff that, you know, I find useful reflections for myself. And then Tankachana added, he said, well, you know, I have my experience with my sister and her child, same kind of a thing. And what they do is they just, you know, if they're stretched for time, don't have much to time that they can offer at a certain point in time, then they'll say, okay, Owen, we've got 5 minutes, and I'm going to put this timer here, and I'm going to set out the clock, and I'll be with you for 5 minutes, and then after that I have to go and do other things. And that's it. And I thought, what a great practical solution. You know, here I was offering, you know, all sorts of internal reflections and ways to be and ways to cope and hold this, and, you know, and I'm the nurse, you know, I'm supposed to come up with practical solutions to these kinds of things, but child rearing is certainly not one of my strong suits. But Tankachana, the PhD physicist, was right there with how to raise a family in some practical terms. So I was really appreciative of that. You know, and I think, you know, and Daniel expressed appreciation for both things. So I think, you know, it's like, it's good to have, you know, some realistic perspectives along with the idealistic ways that we try and approach things too. So if, you know, when all the practical solutions, you know, if there aren't any, or if it is kind of one of those situations that you feel pretty helpless in, then it is good to also be able to develop that sense of acceptance and spaciousness. So we work at it from many different angles. But kind of, you know, doing this kind of acknowledgement of the fact that there is aversion, not adding a second arrow of more aversion on top of the aversion to the aversion, and also kind of realistically assessing a situation and doing what we can do to avoid further damage and to kind of help neutralize the intensity of any kind of aversive emotional state inside of ourselves are ways to deal with it. And then, to me, it's sort of like that then opens the door for being able to cultivate the positive aspect of metta, of loving kindness. Because we haven't compounded the aversion with more aversion, either to ourselves or to other people or situations. And then we can slowly learn to develop this sense of tolerance, of capacity to hold difficult situations, to be able to see maybe the goodness that are that is in everybody, that it's in other people, even when there's unskillful things happening, to attend to the good qualities that anybody has, to set aside that which is maybe not so skillful in how we view other people, and to attend to that which we can encourage and appreciate, and develop a sense of metta, of well-wishing, of caring, of warmth to others, no matter what the circumstances. And there's lots of ways, lots of techniques that are out there in terms of cultivating metta, developing kindness. You know, some of the ways that are taught can be useful. Many people do find them useful. Some of the traditions that come from the commentaries of how to develop metta, people have used to good purpose. Sometimes for me, those particular approaches I get caught in the level of words and language and concepts with the repetition of phrases. And sometimes I've even heard it encouraged in from some of the teachers that's where you need to maintain the practice, at that level of the words, that the words of loving kindness, the affirmations that we make, you know, of may I be happy, may so and so be happy, those kinds of things. Those are the actual object of the meditation, and not to worry so much about the actual feeling of whether the feeling of metta is coming into one's experience or not, but just to concentrate on the repetition of the phrases as a way to develop it. And I have a hard time with that. It just doesn't provide me with a lot of nourishment in developing the practice, and it seems like it becomes a bit just kind of robotic or stale. Not that the words can't be useful sometimes, and sometimes they point in the right direction, and skillful use of language can be a really important part of the practice, but having it point to an actual feeling or an experience of metta, you know, a feeling of caring or concern or warmth or well-wishing. What does that actually feel like? And nourishing that and developing that in whatever way that works. And then allowing oneself to settle into that, to experience that as a very real experience. It can be known in the body. It's an emotional experience, but it also has its counterpoint in the body, and you can feel it and use it as a basis for extending outwards into a more spacious kind of experience. So I find that using sometimes a few key words or a few images to come into mind to help induce that feeling tone, that quality of well-wishing, of kindness, gentleness, warmth. Letting that just kind of smolder and develop in the heart. Sometimes it has to be kind of reinvigorated with some input. And I, you know, one of the ways that I find actually is most useful for me is not necessarily coming up with images of developing a sense of metta to send out to others or to send to myself, but recollecting a time when somebody else was expressing that that quality, was experiencing that quality of well-wishing to me, and was aiding me in some way and spreading that to me in one form or another. And you know, certainly there's experiences in all of our lives when we've had people who are kind to us and wishing us well, and remembering what that feels like to be the recipient of that. Because what happens to me anyway when I remember that is that there's an automatic response of the same kind of feeling, wanting, you know, a sense of well-wishing to that other being who's expressing that to me. So bringing up those kinds of images, I remember there's one that for years now is just a very, it was a very potent experience. It was when I was down at Stanford having some surgery, and it was a fairly major surgery, and I was in the, there were several instances of it actually, because the people there were incredibly attentive and caring, and you know, one of the times that I remember was actually just as I was coming out of the anesthesia and being wheeled down on the stretcher from the operating room into the recovery room, and I was, you know, in this kind of half delirious state coming out of anesthesia, you know, all sorts of imagery and sensory experience, you know, starting to float in, and I remember getting, it seemed like I was about halfway there. I had no idea how I came up with that conclusion, but I was on my way anyway, and kind of coming out of anesthesia. And sometimes what happens when you come out of anesthesia is you get, sometimes people get what's called the rigors, you know, which is this intense trembling, you know, almost involuntary shaking, shivering kind of a feeling, but they're very intense. And that was happening to me. And it wasn't horrible, you know, it was a bit unpleasant, but I wasn't feeling particularly, you know, scared or fearful or anything. I was just vibrating. And then I noticed the nurse's expression on her face, and she was just sort of like, she was so concerned, and she was so, we got to do something about this. So she, you know, rushed me into the recovery room and gave me what I think was probably Demerol, which is the usual antidote for it, and, you know, and they went away, and I could, I kind of looked up in my half dreamy state and saw this look of relief on her face that it stopped. And you know, I think she was suffering more from it than I was, and was so just wanting that to be over for me, and was so happy when it was. And so it sticks very solidly in my mind, that sense of caring and concern. And I bring that back up, and it creates that same sense in me. And then also, you know, I think it was that night, the next day, one of the nursing assistants was similarly just so attentive. I couldn't, you know, I was just, how can these people be so kind? So, you know, just wanting to make sure everything was okay and that I was comfortable, and what could she do? And you know, there's part of me that's also, you know, aware of the fact that I'm a monk, and, you know, we have certain rules of propriety, and, you know, when we're in a hospital situation, those are all kind of pretty much relinquished, but just sort of like, oh, no, I'm fine, everything's fine, you know, don't worry about me, you know, sort of like, you know, no big deal here, and I was feeling fairly comfortable, but she would come and go and check in, and just the sense of caring and concern and well-wishing was, I was just so moved by it. I was very sensitive to that for some reason, and was just so moved by it. And you know, it came time for me to give myself a sponge bath in the morning, and she was there. And can I help? What can I do? You know, oh, no, I'll do it myself, you know. So I was kind of just touching myself up and getting clean a little bit, and, well, can't I even wash your back for you? And I finally just thought, okay, accept the overtures, and so I just sat there and, you know, gave her the opportunity to express that sense of appreciation. And, you know, thinking to myself, well, this is probably not what a monk should be doing, and but this is an exceptional circumstance, and, and maybe I won't worry about what the world around me might think. But I bring that image back and see that sense of concern. There were other people who were equally as sensitive and, you know, helpful at that time. Just the whole time was swimming in this pool of metta. So bringing those images to mind helps establish that very quickly for me when I might be experiencing a bit of, you know, irritation or aversion or, you know, some sort of negative state of mind, just sitting back and recollecting, there is kindness in the world. There is kindness. And I can experience that. I can remember that. And I can feel the same thing for other people. And let that sink into the heart. And then slowly let it broaden, you know, using the imagery of like what we do in the chant, you know, letting it pervade one direction, a second, a third, a fourth, above, below, expand around everywhere. Let that sense gentleness, kindness, concern, well-wishing expand as far as I have the capacity to let it happen. So this is that second quality that the Buddha, or second meditation that the Buddha encourages us to develop. And yeah, there's the third and the fourth ones, the Anapanasati, which to me, once these other practices have been developed, the Asubha practice, you know, the lessening of sensual craving, the settling of the outward going mind towards sensuality, when aversion has been subdued, and then, you know, hopefully other hindrances, looking through the hindrances, you know, we establish alertness and a bit of tranquility and confidence in the practice. Then the practice of Anapanasati is something that comes natural. I find that as my mind settles, at least with the hindrances attenuated, if not in complete abeyance, then the mind will want to naturally gravitate towards being with the breathing. It doesn't want to go anywhere else. It just wants to be with the in and out breathing in a very natural, easy way. It's not anything one has to force. I'm having compassion for Jane Jira's lungs. And then the fourth contemplation of impermanence is one that one can develop as the mind settles, as the hindrances are settling, as the concentration is developing. Then there's the spaciousness to really start to explore the impermanence of all phenomena, anicca, dukkha, anatta, but really watching the arising and ceasing of phenomena. Right in this very moment, not just as a theoretical possibility or as an intellectual concept, but the quiet mind settling into knowing the truth of that which arises also ceases, right here and now in this very moment. So these are the four fundamental practices that the Buddha offered to Meghya as a way of balancing many different factors, and they offer different aspects of training for us. And just to reemphasize that, you know, we need a selection of tools for different circumstances in the way that difficulties manifest, in the way that greed, hatred, and delusion are manifesting in our practice, and many different ways to approach different things so that we can lead to a greater ease, a greater sense of understanding of how not to be taken away with these different kinds of mind states. So I'll offer that for tonight's reflection.
Sadhu.